We were heartbroken over it. But now I wish I could tell you otherwise. But after numerous ultrasounds and blood draws, we have determined that my pregnancy is once again not progressing and is not viable. And once again, I have scheduled an appointment to terminate my pregnancy. I don't think people should have to justify their abortions, but I'm choosing to talk about why I made this decision, because I want us to be able to have meaningful conversations about the reality of how the work that we do in this body impacts people in the real world.
That's Arizona State Senator Eva Birch, a former nurse practitioner who worked at a women's health clinic and has been widely critical of abortion restrictions in Arizona, where abortions are banned after 15 weeks of pregnancy, no exceptions for rape or incest. State Senator Eva Birch is joining us now from Phoenix. We welcome you to Democracy Now! And let me start by saying you publicly announced plans last week to have an abortion. I can't believe we're talking about this globally. Did you have the procedure? And what was it like to have to make this public to everyone? And as you did this, Republicans walked out of the state Senate.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on the show today. You know, I felt like it was really important for me to bring people along so that people could really see what this looks like. I'm at this critical intersection in the abortion conversation because I've been a healthcare provider, I've been a patient seeking abortion care, and now as a lawmaker, I knew that my perspective was unique and I wanted to share that. I wanted to pull people into the conversation so we could be more honest about what abortion care looks like in Arizona, but this is happening all over the country, and who the abortion patient is, and really try to break through some of the stigma and some of the misunderstanding about abortion care and hopefully move the needle in the right direction.
And Senator, could you talk about how your profession as a health provider and a nurse practitioner has influenced your approach, the conversations perhaps you've had with other women in similar situations?
Certainly, I worked in the reproductive health care space for some time. I don't work in abortion care because that's not something that's available to me as a nurse practitioner, but I have had patients who were pregnant, who had questions, patients who were concerned about whether or not Arizona is a hospitable environment for someone who is pregnant, patients who are unsure about whether or not continuing their pregnancy is the right decision for them. And we have to counsel them with the understanding that our laws here are in flux, that abortion care is not guaranteed in Arizona by any means, not only for patients who are just uncertain about whether or not they want to continue their pregnancy, but for patients who might be experiencing complications in their pregnancy or pregnancy loss the way that I was.
You spoke. Could you go ahead, Juan.
Can you talk about the reaction since you made your announcement from other members of the Senate as well as protesters, how you and your family have coped with that?
Yes, I have had an overwhelmingly positive response. It has really been moving for me. I have had people sending me letters to the legislature. I have had emails and messages and direct messages on social media to the tune of thousands. And what I'm mostly receiving are people telling me their own stories or just thanking me for giving them a seat at the table. I think that people really don't want to bring people along with them to with their abortion experiences. This is highly personal and it's a little bit taboo. And often it's a sensitive subject. People don't want to talk about it, but they want to be heard. And I think people are just really grateful for this opportunity to pull people in and to have a voice, to have a seat at the table. Now, as far as the reaction within the legislature, I haven't had any of my Republican colleagues reach out to me to talk about this, not in the way that maybe I would have hoped for, but I wasn't overly optimistic about that. It wasn't so much about trying to convince my colleagues as much as it was about trying to bring light to what's happening in Arizona so that our constituents can make decisions for themselves and hopefully get engaged in the political process and help us to elect pro-choice candidates up and down the ticket. That's really what we need in Arizona and in this country to make real change.
In one of the articles, many about you, State Senator Birch, they said You said that I was told I could choose adoption. I was told I could choose parenting, which were two things that I couldn't choose. It was cruel to suggest that that was an option for me when it's not. If you could explain that, then also what it was like to have these Republicans walk out on you, one of them, a female state legislator, walking in thinking you were done with your speech, then walking out for the second time.
Yes. So I think that a lot of people don't really understand the ways that laws can be sort of weaponized against patients, not to necessarily ban abortion, but to make abortion inaccessible or a difficult experience, to create a hostile environment in the abortion clinic, to create confusion in the patient and provider relationship. And we have a lot of that in Arizona. There is this mandatory counseling where they have to talk about adoption and parenting as alternatives to abortion, which of course is not always relevant to patients, which is why it should be medical providers who are determining the appropriate counseling for their patients. They also have to talk about the probable physical and anatomical properties of the fetus at the time that your abortion will take place, which again, certainly in my case, but in general, is inappropriate and unnecessary. And my pregnancy was not progressing. My embryo was dying and not subject to the probabilities of a normal, healthy pregnancy. So that information was also just factually inaccurate for me. But that's what the providers are required to do because of out of touch legislators who don't have any medical professional experience, who are writing the laws and dictating what doctors have to say to patients in that environment. As far as my Republican colleagues filtering in and out and not really listening to what I had to say, I have a couple of thoughts on that. One of them is just that I think that these laws are intended to do what they did. So I don't think that they are surprised by it or concerned about it. I think that really it just reinforces that what they're doing with these laws has having the intended impact. So I don't think that there's necessarily any need for my Republican colleagues to hear what I have to say, because they're not going to make any changes or do things any differently because of that. I will also say that I have good relationships with a number of my Republican colleagues. We disagree on a lot of things. It's really the leadership in the Arizona Senate that is so skewed far to the right. They are extremists, and they really have sort of set themselves up for failure in that way. But I didn't experience anything that I wasn't expecting in the chamber that day.
We just have 30 seconds. If you could respond to the mifepristone oral arguments in the Supreme Court.
Yes. I mean, I can't believe we're even talking about it, to be honest with you. I mean, mifepristone has, what is it, 26 years of safety data and is extremely safe and effective medication. I think that we cannot be setting this precedent where we are allowing religious or extremist organizations to be able to go to highly partisan Trump-appointed judges and bring a case all the way up to the Supreme Court. I just really hope that they do the right thing. It's unimaginable that this is where we are with the mifepristone case. We use this medication so much more safely than so many medications that you can buy over the counter. It's an outrageous conversation that we're having with this, but I am hoping that the right decision will be made. But it just goes to show how serious the consequences are when we have someone like Trump, who is designing a highest court in the land for the people of this country. And we have to be so conscious of that and to work so hard to make sure that we are making better decisions in November.
Eva Birch, Democratic Arizona State Senator, nurse practitioner, announced in her speech on the state Senate floor that she planned to get an abortion last week to call attention to the restrictions she and others now face. When we come back to Baltimore, where six workers who were on the Francis Scott Key Bridge when it collapsed are presumed dead, from Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. Stay with us. El aire en suspenso y medieval, con orillas afiladas, las estrellas. Noche, Nighttime by Fuensanta. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Authorities in Maryland fear six missing construction workers died on Tuesday when the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsed after a massive cargo ship crashed into a support column. Maryland's governor said the crew on the ship was able to issue an emergency May Day call before colliding with the bridge, which allowed authorities to stop incoming traffic. This is audio from Broadcastify.com archive of Maryland Transportation Authority first responder radio traffic just before the bridge collapsed.
Yeah, if we can stop traffic, just make sure no one's on the bridge right now. I'm not sure where there's a crew up there. You might want to notify whoever the foreman is, see if we can get them off the bridge temporarily.
10-4, once the other unit gets here, I'll ride up on the bridge. I have all interloop traffic stopped at this time. But once you get here, I'll go grab the workers on the Key Bridge and then stop the outer loop.
C-13 dispatch, the whole bridge just fell down. Everybody. The whole bridge just collapsed.
Authorities are still investigating the cause of the crash, but say the ship leaving Baltimore Harbor lost propulsion and control of vessel around 1:30 a.m. Tuesday. The crew of men who were filling potholes on the bridge were from Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, had been in this country for many years. They include Salvadoran father of three named Miguel Luna, Honduran father of two named Maynor Yasser Suazo Sandoval, two Guatemalan men, and at least one Mexican national. In a minute, we'll speak with Maximilian Alvarez, editor-in-chief of the Baltimore-based news outlet The Real News, who's been reporting on the bridge collapse. On Wednesday, he interviewed Jesus Campos, who's Salvadoran and works for Bronner Builders, the company that employed the workers on the bridge.
We do concrete repair on the bridge. We remove the damaged concrete and put new concrete. That is what we do at the company.
At night, with fewer cars?
Yes, with less traffic. We enter at 9 p.m. until 5 a.m. That is the time they give us. But we have worked there for a long time, and there has never been a mishap like what happened.
Yes, it was a horrible disaster. Do you know if the workers got any warning?
No.
No, I understand they were on their half-hour break that they give them, like they were inside the trucks. There were four trucks or five trucks that have to be on site. They were inside the trucks, supposedly.
For more, we're joined by Maximilian Alvarez, editor-in-chief of The Real News, based in Baltimore. Welcome to Democracy Now! Condolences to your city. And if you can start off by talking about what you've learned about these workers. I mean, the warning did go out, albeit there was just a few minutes, enough time to stop all the traffic from going over the bridge. Talk about what more you understand about these men. Eight, two have been saved, one in critical condition, and six presumed dead.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here. But as you rightly said, you know, our hearts are broken today here in Baltimore. There's a hole in our hearts as big as the gap where the bridge used to be, and there's a hole in these families that will never be filled again. And that's really what's first and foremost on our minds today. And there's still a lot that needs to be learned and investigated about this story. But as you mentioned, what we know and what Jesus Campos told me yesterday and what I've seen from other reports coming out is that, you know, these workers who work for Bronner Builders, you know, a contractor that's been in operation for decades and contracts with the state of Maryland on many other projects, you know, that these workers were working with Bronner in the middle of the night to fix potholes on the Key Bridge. The men who we believe now to be dead, six of whom, you know, like were on that bridge, were, according to Jesus, on their 30-minute lunch break, sitting in their cars or near their cars when the bridge itself collapsed. When I asked Jesus if he knew that if the crew received any warning about the May Day call, he told me very explicitly, no, they did not. And I believe that we hear that in the police dispatcher, right? The police knew that there was no direct line to the foreman and to the folks on that bridge, and so the police were racing to block traffic coming in on either side of the bridge and were waiting for backup so that one of the officers could go onto the bridge and warn the crew. But every second that went by, was a second lost, and they did not have time to reach the crew on the bridge. But I think the more egregious problem and the question we should be asking about is why the folks on that bridge doing that dangerous work in the middle of the night had no direct line to emergency dispatch when they are clearly working in a potentially hazardous environment and these massive mega, ships are passing beneath their feet. And so far, that's what we know. I mean, there are, again, details that need to be confirmed, but there's a lot in this story that will appear different if you don't know construction workers, don't know a lot of immigrants, don't know a lot of undocumented immigrants. Just one example, and I'm not saying this is exactly what happened, but I'm saying that I've watched a lot of local news in the city over the past 24 hours, and there were reportedly two workers who were pulled alive from the water yesterday, one of whom went to the hospital, one who reportedly refused emergency care, refused transport to the hospital. And so anchors have been saying, well, I guess that person was fine and they just went home. That may be the case. But again, if you know workers in construction, you know immigrants and undocumented folks, your mind immediately thinks that was a worker who was deathly afraid of going to the hospital because they may be undocumented. And that's a situation that so many workers in this country are actually in right now. And I can only imagine, after going through that, if that was the case, what must be going through a person's mind to refuse emergency services at that moment. So there's still a lot to be uncovered, but right now the families are grieving, the fellow workers are grieving. Jesus was largely in shock when I talked to him, and I was very emotional afterwards, having talked to him as well. My foster daughter is from Honduras. She's undocumented. She's sharing posts with me all day from Honduras of people trying to figure out if these were their family members. It's devastating, Amy.
Maximilian, I wanted to ask you this issue of Latino workers and immigrant workers being killed or injured on the job has been a national problem and almost epidemic for years that hasn't been given little attention. 18% of all workers in the United States are Latinos, but 23% of the fatalities at workplaces are among Latinos and disproportionately among immigrant workers. Your response to this, these facts, vis-a-vis the constant, what we hear in the media all the time about migrants being criminals and being a danger to society?
I appreciate the question, Juan, and I think this is really important. This is something I want to really stress for people. I mean, first and foremost, as you said, the reason that so many folks are reaching out because they feel connected to this story, even though this was a unique, horrible accident, there are so many elements in this story that working people around the country feel connected to. I was just in East Palestine, Ohio this weekend. I've had residents there texting me all day because they feel connected to this in a way. And I've had construction workers and building trades folks doing the same. Why? Because construction is still one of the most deadliest jobs in this country, far deadlier than police, right? I mean, we just last year, six crewmen on a construction crew were killed when a car in Baltimore County, when a car barreled into them. That's just as many who died yesterday. And each one of those lives is precious, and we should care just as much about those lives that are lost. We're killing over 10 times as many construction workers just by roadside accidents around this country every year alone. Those lives matter too. But as you mentioned, Juan, I mean, this is not just about, construction workers. This is not just about contractors and all of that. I mean, the problem is so much bigger here, and it really goes to the heart of the discourse that we're having in this country, where Donald Trump and the people who have been poisoned by his evil rhetoric and anti-immigrant stances, they are vilifying people who look like me, people who look like Jesus, people like the men on that bridge, people like my foster daughter and her friends and her boyfriend who works construction, right? That could have been us. That could have been any one of us. And we, Jesus and I knew that when we were talking to each other. And You know, I think that the thing that, like, is really important to stress to people is, like, we are not coming to this country to ruin it. We're not the evil people. We're not the enemies. We're workers just like you. We're neighbors, right? While we're being talked about as, like, this invading horde that's coming to destroy the country, what does this story actually show us? That immigrants are filling our potholes at night so that we can have a smooth drive to work in the morning. Immigrant workers are, and the contractors who employ them and exploit the contracting relationship, which happens all across the country. That's why you find brown kids, you know, children working in meatpacking plants, cleaning bone saws in the middle of the night. That's why you find children, primarily brown migrant children who should be in school, working in Hyundai parts distributors in Alabama. And yet Hyundai can say it's not responsible for that because it's a contractor, subcontractor, yada, yada, yada. This goes so much deeper. There are workers like this who are working in slave-like conditions in our country right now, picking the tomatoes that go on your Wendy's hamburger. And yet we are contributing to this country. We want to make a better life for ourselves and our families, just like the families who are grieving right now because those six men are never going to come home. Like, we are not your enemy. We are your fellow workers. We are your neighbors. Our children are your children's friends in school. And I hope more than anything that people can see this and see the humanity in us and see that this idea that immigrants are somehow destroying our country when, you know, like, corporate greed and all the corruption is causing catastrophes from East Palestine to Boeing to what have you. Like, the enemies are clear. We are not it. We are just here trying to make a life for our families and work and make and live a comfortable, dignified life. And I don't know why that's such a hard thing for so much of the country to understand.
Well, Max, I want to thank you so much for being with us. We'd like to ask you to stay beyond the end of the show so we can conduct this interview in Spanish and put it on our website in Spanish. Maximilian Alvarez, editor-in-chief of The Real News, based in Baltimore, Maryland. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're ending today's show in Texas, where some 200 tactical Border Force soldiers with the Texas National Guard were deployed in El Paso Tuesday. This comes after Texas erected a second border fence covered in razor wire Friday, and riot police attacked migrants who tried to pull it down. The federal spending bill Biden signed into law this weekend increases funding for ICE and Customs and Border Patrol. This also comes as Texas's harsh new anti-immigrant state law was put back on hold by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals last week after the Supreme Court briefly lifted a stay, SB4 giving local police sweeping powers to arrest and deport anyone they suspect of entering the United States without authorization. For more, we go to El Paso, where we're joined by Fernando Garcia, founder and executive director of Border Network for Human Rights. Fernando, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk about these 200 soldiers that have been deployed to the border and also the whole debate over SB4 that almost went into effect if the Supreme Court had their way, then didn't because of a lower court ruling?
Hey, good morning, Amy and Juan. Yes, thanks for having me again. Listen, I mean, we have a very a situation at the border where the state of Texas is massively militarizing our community, especially here in El Paso, but also in the rest of the Mexico-Texas border. Just to give you a little bit of context already, is that the state of Texas has deployed 10,000 state soldiers already, the National Guard troops in our communities, especially along the border, and now we see an increase of that militarization, and I think we're very concerned, specifically having special troops or special forces coming to El Paso with no training on how to deal with civilian population and much less dealing with immigrants and children and refugees. So I think this is just, again, the effort of the state of Texas to usurp the federal powers especially enforcing border enforcement laws or, in this case, immigration laws. So, again, we believe that it's not only illegal what the state of Texas is doing, but also it is violating many people's rights, especially in El Paso region.
And Fernando, could you talk about the decision by President López Obrador in Mexico? He blasted Texas's SB 4 law and said that Mexico won't accept anyone deported under that law.
Yes, yes. And to be very clear, what the state of Texas has done immigration enforcement and deportation system, from actually allowing the police officers, state police, ask immigration status, ask, show me your papers questions, but also detain, arrest members in the community in Texas, especially Latino members, and then a state magistrate, a state judge, would decide the deportation of that person that was arrested. And this is impacting not only migrants or refugees that are coming across the border, but also everybody in Texas, whether they're, you're in Houston and Dallas and Fort Worth, so everybody would be subjected to as before. So what Presidente López Obrador did is that he said essentially that he's not recognizing the authority of Texas to actually enforce federal immigration laws and start deporting either Mexicanos, Salvadoreños, or any other immigrants back to Mexico. So I think that was the right decision. But however, the state of Texas is still building up this immigration state force.
And also, the new spending bill that President Biden just signed, it provides a massive increase to ICE detention infrastructure and for more money for the Customs and Border Patrol and ICE. Your response?
Well, that is unfortunate, again, I mean, because we know what some extremist politicians like Mr. Greg Abbott is doing already in Texas, which, by the way, other states now are trying to mirror as before, in Georgia and Louisiana. And the fact that the federal government doesn't have an alternative to that, doesn't have not only an alternative policy, but also an alternative narrative to this so-called invasion of criminals, the way that migrants are being portrayed, it just add to the problems, because we don't need more detention centers in the interior or at the border. We don't need more Border Patrol, as is in the DHS funding that was just approved. What we needed was more welcoming centers. We needed more accountability and oversight to federal law enforcement at the border, but also we needed for the federal government to stop Texas, stop the governor of what they are doing in terms of enforcing illegally and unconstitutionally, as before, that is impacting Latinos, people of color, migrants that are looking for asylum and protection. I mean, what you saw in El Paso, the pictures of people running through the barbed wire, it is how desperate the situation is at the border. Because these state soldiers, barbed wire, and this state enforcement, it is illegally impeding migrants and families to ask for asylum, which is the right, it's an international right, it's granted in the U.S. Constitution. So I think that we expected the administration to be more forceful in accomplishing more humane and border and push for immigration reform. We had not seen that. Instead, we had seen more militarization and more resources for detention centers coming from the administration also.
Ando, we want to thank you for being with us and ask you to stay after the show to conduct this interview in Spanish. Fernando Garcia, founder and executive director of the Border Network for Human Rights, based in El Paso, Texas. That does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Guzder, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Maria Studio, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
It's March, and you know what that means. It's les rendezvous de la francophonie.
Check out rvf.ca to discover all the activities and contests happening across Canada.
Diverse, independent, yours. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse, independent, yours.